Right, good morning everyone. Yeah, welcome to the, well, it's unfortunately the last talk of the weekend, so I'm delighted to have Paddy Shannon here talking about socialist decision making and the rule of three. So yeah, thank you very much, Paddy.
Okay, thanks. The reason I'm doing this is because, well, you know, we're looking at aspects of socialist society, and democracy is of course a crucial aspect of that. I actually suggested that Bill Martin do this because Bill knows quite a lot about different models of democracy, so I thought he'd be perfect for this, but for some reason he didn't. So what I've done is this is the opportunity to return to a bit of a pet subject of mine. I first got interested in the 1990s, late 90s, when the World Wide Web started, and suddenly a lot of kind of cherished institutions began to look very dated very quickly. And one of those was the representational or delegate model of democracy. There was a lot of excited talk at the time about direct democracy, because, you know, voting for something directly yourself is obviously more democratic in principle than indirect voting via a representative. No matter how fair you try to make that, it's obviously more representative for you to do it yourself. Okay, anyway, so that's the kind of the setup, if you like. So I'd like to start with a quote. This is a sort of warning quote, which a lot of you will have definitely heard before, and it goes like this: many forms of government have been tried and will be tried in this world of sin and woe. No one pretends that democracy is perfect or all-wise. Indeed, it has been said that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. As you know, of course, that was Winston Churchill. I was trying to sound a bit like him then, but... now, the reason I wanted to remind you of that quote is, for two reasons. That, first of all, no form of democracy is perfect. So what I'm going to talk about is not a perfect form of democracy, because there is no such thing. In fact, this is why I thought Bill would be quite informative on this, because there are various forms of proportional representation. However you sort of slice the cake, somebody loses out, somebody doesn't get what they want. In certain forms of proportional representation, the majority don't get what they want, their first choice. You end up with a sort of second choice or a third choice compromise that doesn't really please anybody. So however you work the democracy, it's not going to be perfect. So that was my first reason for me making that, reminding you of that quote. And the second one is where Churchill says, he talks about democracy and other forms that have been tried from time to time. He's talking about things that have been tried before. And this brings me back to my first point, which is that in the late 90s, there was a revolution, a technical revolution, with the internet, World Wide Web. This created the possibility for things that haven't been tried before. All right, so that's the other reason for mentioning this. I've been in the socialist party since the early 1980s, when EC minutes would take weeks or sometimes months to arrive by post, and conference was a huge affair held in big town halls in Chiswick, and everything was written down, everything was by telephone, and back then members used to speculate about how socialism would work. I remember there was one guy who was famous for getting up and sort of describing how socialism would involve huge administrations made up of telephone exchanges in large halls containing typing pools, you know, hundreds and hundreds of typists in these huge kind of municipal halls, and this sort of thing. Because and even the sort of more far-sighted people weren't thinking in terms of computers in the 80s; they just weren't really a thing. So in the pre-internet world, let's say the pre-1980s, 1990s. So the standard of socialist democracy back then was mandatory democracy. So it's a bit like now, except with our representational democracy. We tell them what we want them to do. They completely ignore us. They go off and do what they want with their snouts in the trough for 5 years, and then they come back to us to try and coax a little X out of us for another 5 years, jollies on their part. That's a representational democracy. So obviously the socialist version of that is to say it's a mandatory democracy. We tell you what we want, you go and do it. If you don't do it, we'll recall you immediately and we'll get somebody who will do it. So it's a mandatory democracy. Much fairer, obviously, you'll agree. But still, it involves your opinion being aggregated with an awful lot of other opinions, sent forward to the next level where it's represented by a mandated delegate. That mandated delegate's view or vote is then aggregated with all the other delegate views or votes. That's then sent to the next level. And you can see that by the end of the vote, your personal opinion counts for very little. Okay, so that's the situation that we have. So what we're proposing, what the party's always proposed, is very like what exists already, with a small but very crucial difference. Now the advantage of that is that it's easy to understand. You know, you explain that to anybody and they'll go, oh yeah, that's like councils, local councils, regional, county councils, local, national government administration, whatever you call it, etc., etc. They can understand that, United Nations. On the downside, it looks exactly like what we've got today. In fact, I had the experience last year of being interviewed online, doing an interview with an American blogger, podcaster. He was a libertarian, actually, a right-wing libertarian. He was actually very nice. He gave me a lot of time to explain. So he was very, it was a decent interview. But he couldn't get this thing. He said, but it sounds like governments. What you're describing sounds exactly like what we've got. And even though I explained, well, yeah, but it's mandated, it's not representational, he still didn't really get it. He just said, well, it sounds like what we've got, it sounds like governments. You don't sound any different from what we've got. So I think that's a downside as well. It doesn't sound revolutionary. When you talk to people about councils and or council sessions and all this sort of thing, people go, oh, God. It's like, honestly, we have this picture of socialism where we'll all be sitting, you know, my son said to me, oh, God, you socialism will never work. You're sitting in meetings all day long voting on things. You'll never get anything done. And that is how people see it. Unfortunately, because of the way we represent our democracy, that's how we make it sound. And we make it sound crushingly boring as well, all this business with councils and the regional committees. It really does sort of sound quite deadening. So I tend to think of it, why are we still sticking to this? It's a 19th century solution to a 19th century problem, essentially, which is, you know, it's a compromise. It's built around the limitations of time and space. So, you know, time to travel, well, money to travel as well now, and, you know, geographical constraints. You simply can't fit the whole population of a country into a big conference hall, no matter how big it is. So, you know, these were the sort of physical restrictions which our democratic model was set up to, to deal with. And it's been like that, you know, ever since, I suppose, ancient Greece. So it's probably time for a change. So there are certain reasons to not find mandatory democracy, even mandatory democracy, very attractive. So, you know, it imposes a vote on, it imposes a say on who has a vote and who doesn't, based on the fairly arbitrary condition of where you happen to live at that moment, not on what your ideas are, what your opinions are, what your level of interest is, none of that. It's just, you live there, you can vote. You don't live there, you can't vote. Right? Whether you might know something about this, but you can't vote because you don't live there. You know absolutely sod all about it and don't care, but you can vote because you do live there. So it's arbitrary in that way, imposing a geographical condition which nowadays is quite irrelevant. And also bear in mind that in socialism it may be that populations are a lot more mobile than they are today. If you think most of us, I mean lots of us like where we live and we want to stay there, that's fine, but probably most people live where they live not out of choice. They're anchored there by work, or they're anchored there by a mortgage like an albatross around their neck. They can't move, they can't afford to go anywhere. If they could move, they probably would. So let's just, I tend to assume that in socialism the population would be much more mobile than today, especially young people wanting to explore the world. Why not? If it's all free and you can go anywhere, why wouldn't you do that? So our democratic model assumes a static population that has its franchise based on their geographical location. So I don't think that's a bit out of date. Also, it imposes an arbitrary age distinction. You know, some people say to us, what age can you join, you have to be to join the Socialist Party? Well, we don't really have a rule, actually. We don't have a rule at all about that. We tend to think people themselves can decide if they're old enough to understand the ideas of socialism and to take part in the process of being in the Socialist Party, then they're old enough to join, and we'll interview them, we'll talk to them, just as we would to anybody else. So we don't set an age limit. Well, I would argue that in socialism, the same thing should apply to voting. It shouldn't be there shouldn't be some hard and fast and arbitrary age limit like 16 or 18. It's different for different people. Also, the mandatory democratic model kind of assumes that all those voters who are entitled to vote not only will vote, but should vote. In other words, they should be interested in the questions that occur, the issues that occur in their particular geographical area. And the corollary to this is if they don't vote, if they choose not to vote in the issues affecting their geographical area, there's either something wrong with them or there's something wrong with the democratic process itself. In other words, non-compliance or non-involvement is a sign that there's something wrong with the process. Okay, now bear that in mind, because that's going to become quite relevant later on. Non-compliance, non-involvement would be seen in that, with that model, is seen as something akin to antisocial behaviour. Okay, that's, I think, when I return to that later, you'll see why I think that's a really bad way to go about your democracy. Okay, now also possibly apologies if I'm overstating the case here, but I do want to say that the thing with mandatory democracy, it's not just that it's a bit out of date, oh look, there's a really clever, cool, high-tech way of doing it. I'm not just saying it's a bit dated, I'm actually saying it's dysfunctional, it doesn't really work, it never has really worked, and I don't only mean representative democracy and capitalism, I'm saying that the actual model itself doesn't work very well, and never has. So let me just try and explain what I mean. Let's take capitalist democracy for a minute because we're most familiar. So we know that works as a hierarchy. So it's I don't need to explain to you what that is, but you've got several steps up the hierarchy: central government at the top, regional councils spreading out from that, and local city councils from there, and wards and all that sort of thing like that. So it's a hierarchy, it's an upside down tree. Now, in socialism, we talk about a horizontal hierarchy. That's a phrase that's been used a few times. We talk about horizontal hierarchy. Now, the way to understand a horizontal hierarchy is to look at your hierarchy that I've just explained, like that, the branches, and turn it up so that you're looking at it from the top, from the top view. Okay, now I can just illustrate this. if anybody's online, I haven't done this diagram. It's just a quick diagram of a top, of a lateral view of a hierarchy. So you see all the steps there, and then if you, I should have put this on the screen, but it's just a basic, so you can get the idea. Then if you look at it from the top down, what you see is, it looks like a target. It looks like a dartboard or a archery target. That's what a horizontal hierarchy would look like. Okay. Meaning that the people who work in the red bullseye bit, they're the same people. They're the same rights and all the same things in socialism as all the people who don't work in the bullseye. They're not more important because they work in the bullseye. They're not super powerful politicians as they would be today. They're just socialists like everybody else who happen to be working in that central organisational part. Okay, so that's the idea of the bullseye. That's the horizontal hierarchy. Okay, so what I want to do straight away here is say, when you represent it in that really, really simplified schematic like that, it looks perfectly reasonable. It looks quite, that is the same as that, but that's a sort of egalitarian version, and it looks perfectly fine. You could be either in the central bit, or you could be in the outer ring, the middle ring here, or the outer ring here. It looks quite doable. But this isn't scale, okay? What I want you to imagine, if I just flip it over, is what happens when, instead of these levels being, just three little local councils here, there are something like 30,000 of them. And these regional or country things, there's 250 of them. And then this top one is somehow some global overview of 250 of these, and each one of those has got 30 in it, and each one of those has probably got 50 in it. It's absolutely gigantic. And then your bullseye starts to look more like this. Okay, where you've got a very large. Ooh, okay.
Yeah, that happened yesterday.
It did. Okay, that seems all right. Yeah. Okay. Again, all I've done for. I'm sorry I didn't put this on the screen. I might have to turn that off. Don't need it now anyway. What's happened with this bullseye? With the this. Archery target is all the rings have shrunk inwards, creating a huge outer area and a tiny central area and a bullseye that has shrunk so much that it's virtually molecular. That's what it would realistically look like. It wouldn't look like this. It would look more like that. Now, the problems start to appear at this point. The communications between the centre and any part of the periphery are overstretched and overcomplicated by having too many links in it. So the people involved in the centre would start to become very separated and cut off from information from the peripheries like this. Now, I don't want to labour the point, but we've seen similar things happen in our own organisation. When we've tried to operate this kind of democracy, what we've noticed is, and you can say the same of any other organisation trying to do this, is that you get certain, it's a syndrome. We see this as a kind of syndrome. So what happens is, and I'll give you some examples, you'll be very familiar with this. There's issues, so I've mentioned issues of communication. There's noise in the communication line. So it's like that old game of Chinese whispers. You're trying to whisper a message around a group, and by the time it gets to the last person, it's completely changed into something else. So that's noise in the communication chain. When you have institutional setups like committees, it tends to discourage spontaneity outside those committees. Everyone thinks, well, there's a committee for doing that, they should be doing that, I don't need to do anything. And that's kind of groupthink that loads and loads of organisations get into. Even NASA suffered from groupthink, which is one of the reasons why their space shuttles crashed. Because everyone thought someone else was dealing with that problem, when in fact, in reality, nobody was dealing with that problem. That's groupthink. And that's what you get with structured organisations, including us. There's a tendency in these situations for information to centralise, and also the control over the information centralises. And the result of that is only the people in the centre really know what's going on, because they can communicate more easily and more often, with the result that they form a kind of charmed circle, which starts to look very like a leadership clique. Now, I got a letter from a member who lives in France recently, who accused us of having a leadership clique.
Okay.
A leadership clique.
Yeah.
Those people who are the activists who work in, who, you know, on the EC and things like this. Now, he's not the only person who's done that. We had somebody leave recently who accused the EC of being a leadership clique. It's complete nonsense. These are things that people say when they don't understand how the party works, and they're on the periphery, and they don't really see what's going on, and they think that the people who do know what's going on are this leadership clique. This is the syndrome that I'm talking about. It's really unfair of them to criticise those activists for doing that, for actually doing, you know, what they do. But you've got to understand it from their perception. They feel left out of the loop, they feel shut out, they don't have any information, and they do see these people talking to each other all the time, and to them it does look like a leadership clique. So, and it goes on, the more shut out they feel, the less motivated they feel, the less involved they are, the less inclined they are to get involved, the more they resent the people who are involved, and by the same token, the people who are active find themselves being more and more work being dumped on them, and they can't understand why they can't engage the people in the periphery. Anyway, so I'm saying everybody, probably most people here, recognise that syndrome in our party, but you could see that in almost any party, I would say, in any group, in any organisation. I've certainly seen it in companies that I've worked for, the same sort of thing. Okay. So I think I've said quite a lot already about the systemic problems of this hierarchy model. Even if you call it a horizontal hierarchy, it is still a hierarchy, and it does still have the same systemic problems that any hierarchical model has. Okay. Now, as I say, when I was interested in sort of cyberpunk geeky stuff in the 1990s, it was all very exciting. We were looking into, some of us were looking into direct democracy, and it's a completely different model. Now, there was an educationalist, educational reformer in the 1950s called John Dewey, and he coined the term organic democracy, which I didn't realise at the time. I thought I'd made the term up, but in fact it was his term. And what he meant was, instead of democratic structures, pre-existing democratic structures in society being design-led and then imposed by the collective, his idea was that the democratic process sort of grew, if you like, grew spontaneously out of the individual. So, I suppose to put it another way, instead of building a big conference hall in the middle of a town, and then you've got a conference hall, so you've got to have conferences, his idea was, no, the democracy comes from the individual. If the individual says, you know what, we need a conference, well, then you organise a conference. You don't just have a conference because there's a conference hall. So that's the organic approach to capitalism, to democracy. But, I mean, John Dewey couldn't get anywhere with his ideas because his critics said, well, how are you going to make that work in contemporary society? Because organic democracy meant the individual expressing their own free will in a way that was absolutely impossible in capitalism then, and still is in capitalism today. So John Dewey couldn't do anything with his ideas back then, and they were largely dismissed. I came across this idea of organic democracy accidentally when I was looking at I thought, what do the anarchists have to say about democracy? They always have some quite creative views on democracy. Some of them are a bit daft, like consensus, but lots of other anarchists say that consensus politics doesn't work either. I was directed to their, there's an anarchist FAQ, it's called. It's on LibCom, and it's 4,000 pages long. It's absolutely gigantic. But I found their section on democracy, and I was quite surprised, actually, to discover that they propose, this is kind of the anarchist Bible, you know, really, and they propose this exact same form of horizontal hierarchy that we do, mandatory democracy. It's word for word, you know, we're the same on that. So I was quite surprised, because elsewhere, I can't remember who it was or where I found it, but I came across the idea of self-organising clusters, self-organising groups, so that people would organise around the problem, like antibodies around an infection. And the idea was people would organise around the problem to the extent that the problem existed, and then when the problem had gone away, the organisation would go away. So it did not presuppose any pre-existing structures. The structures formed organically, like the organic democracy thing, and then dissipated when they were no longer needed. So no permanent structures were assumed. So I started with that, and I thought, well, you could work with that with a system of direct democracy, but the so the question of direct democracy is the absolute most pressing one is who gets to vote on what? You can't have the whole world's population in socialism voting on everything. That's ridiculous. So you could have, if you wanted to, armies of lawyers, or ex-lawyers, I suppose, drawing up guidelines and rule books, and, you know, we have a rule book in the party, and, you know, so you could do it that way if you wanted. You could try and, you know, find a rule for every situation, for every individual. If you want to find out how you can vote on and what you can vote on, here's your rule book, and it's 4,000 pages long. Off you go, enjoy. Okay, but then I thought, well, how do we work out in socialism what people are entitled to take from the common store? Well, we don't decide. We let them decide. We say it's from each according to their self-defined need. Because if their need isn't self-defined, then we become a tyranny. We're telling people what they can have and what they can't have. That's not socialism. It might be state socialism, but it's not real socialism. So why don't we apply the same process to voting that we apply to everything else? What can you vote on? It's up to you to decide what you vote on. Okay? How does that work in practice? Well, it seems to me that you can make this work with one assumption and three conditions. So, to take the assumption first, the assumption is that the individual will respect and abide by the socialist democratic ethos. Which is to say, from the principle of from each according to self-defined need, from each according to self-defined ability, to each according to self-defined need. I'm stressing the self-defined because it is so important to keep that in mind. That is the assumption. Self-defined because, people have asked this questions like, in socialism, can I have my own private island in an ocean-going yacht? No, you can't, because self-defined doesn't mean that the community has no say. It means that you can decide what you need. But if the community thinks that your decision is unreasonable, then you are actually acting against the democratic ethos. So you're expected to make reasonable demands on the system. You're expected to make your self-defined needs reasonable. If you have, needs like, for example, dialysis, that involves some sort of quite expensive machinery in local hospitals. That's a need. That's perfectly reasonable. Of course it is. But if you wanted your own private yacht, you know, most communities would say, no, fuck off, that's not reasonable.
Oh, but if some communities
Does self-defined ability there also mean if I can, if I want to fly a plane, can I just get in and fly a plane, even though I can't really even push a wheelbarrow? Well, again, no, because that's not a reasonable self-defined ability. So the assumption, let me remind you, the assumption is that you are going to, that each individual is going to be, comply with the democratic ethos of the society. That's an expectation that will be sort of, I think, socialised into people at quite a young age. As children, they'll be expected to behave in that socialist ethos, and that any departure from that would be seen as anti-socialist behaviour, which would be quite embarrassing to be found guilty of that sort of behaviour. People wouldn't want to risk being thought badly of because they had defined a need in an unreasonable way, or they define an ability in an unreasonable way. Okay, so that's the assumption. So now I want to look at the conditions. Now the conditions are, assuming that you're going to answer these conditions honestly, you would say, does this affect me? Number one, does this affect me? Two, do I know about it? And three, do I care? Okay, right. So I'm going to just break these down a little bit for you. So let's take a simple example. I think somebody yesterday came up with a similar example. But so your community has some transport issues, which would be solved by building a new road. But this has consequences, environmental, resource, and aesthetic consequences. So, now according to this rule of three, you self-select into this debate, you self-select into the vote. Okay, anyone can join the discussion, that's a free discussion, but for voting, you self-select in according to the principle of self-defined need. So, how do you self-select into this? You ask yourself for these three questions. Does it affect you, right? Yes, because you normally live in the community, although you might be travelling at the moment. Remember I said that, you know, society might be much more mobile. Do you know about the issue? Yes, you've kept yourself informed on all aspects of it. Do you care? Yes, or you wouldn't have bothered keeping up with the information. All right, so you've met all three conditions. You should vote. Okay, let's change the conditions. Does it affect you? Yes, because you live permanently in the community. Do you know about the issue? Yes, you've kept yourself informed. Do you care? Not really, you aren't bothered either way. So you only meet two conditions out of three. You should choose not to vote. So let's look at other permutations. Does it affect you? No, because you've moved to Barcelona. Do you know about the issue? You know the gist of it. Do you care? Yes, because you like your community and you may move back there at some point. Okay? Now, bear in mind what I said right at the start, that no form of democracy is perfect. This isn't a panacea. This isn't perfect either. And this is a grey area, this one, this here. You've got to call this yourself. But if you decide to opt in, you live in Barcelona, you don't really know the issue, you know the gist. And do you care? Well, yeah, but, you know, okay. So you've got to call this. If you decide to opt in, you may be challenged by locals, by the local community, who point out that you live in Barcelona and also that you've not really been following the debate. Okay. So if you're going to choose to opt in to this vote, you need to be prepared to defend your decision against possible opposition. Now, if you'd rather not be accused of being unethical, you might prefer to step out of the vote in this case. If it's a grey area and you don't want to have an argument, you may think, I'll step out of the vote. But it's still your decision. But there's nothing to stop you taking part in the debate, obviously. Okay, so let's try another condition. Does it affect you? No, because you live elsewhere. Do you know about the issue? Yes, because you're an expert on roads. Do you care? No, not personally, no. So obviously you shouldn't vote. But you could offer your advice if you think it's appropriate, or you could be willing to give it if asked. Okay, it's another one. Does it affect you? Yes. Do you know about the issue? No. Do you care? Yes. Right. Well, this raises the question, if you care, why don't you know about the issue? But the point here is quite clear. You should be involved in the debate, but you should try and find out about the subject in order to meet all three conditions before deciding to vote. If there isn't time, if the decision is too quick, then you may not have time, so you shouldn't vote. Okay. So I just want to look at these three conditions a little bit closer. The first one, what do we mean when we say that something affects us? What does that mean exactly? Affects us to what extent? Affects us physically, psychologically, emotionally, morally possibly? And over what period? For a short term or a long term? And does it affect us directly or indirectly? And what do I mean? When I say something affects me, does that mean that it would affect you in the same way? Is it very subjective, isn't it? This is why it can only be me that decides for me, because it's a subjective question. So for example, let's take an example. Some people here watched a thing called Seaspiracy, and there's some quite ghastly scenes of dolphin slaughters in Norway and also in Japan and places like that. Really quite horrific stuff, and it's very upsetting for a lot of people who are fond of dolphins or vegetarian or both. And it's all tied up with capitalism, but you know, if such things were going on in socialism, I can imagine a lot of people being quite upset about it. So let's suppose that it is going on in socialism, and you would like to have a vote in putting a stop to this. But of course, you don't live in this Japanese village. You don't live anywhere near Japan. What right have you got to take part in their local decisions? But ask yourself: does it affect me? Yeah, it upsets me. I'm probably upset. Do you know about it? Yes, I'm an expert in dolphins actually, and I'm an activist for dolphin welfare. I know all about dolphins. Okay, yeah, so second condition. Do I care? Third condition. Well, of course I care, you know. I meet all three conditions. I should vote. But I don't live in Japan, I'm nowhere near there. Well, in this case, the Japanese community are going to say, I'm sorry, you're not going to vote in this. This is not your business. You live the other side of the world. And once again, I refer you to the point at the start. No system of democracy is perfect. You cannot always get your way. If the community says that you're not entitled to vote, then you're not. Even though you've decided it, and you've decided it for valid reasons in your view. So, you can't always get your way under any system. Okay, so what do we mean by informed? Like, do you know about the subject? What does that mean exactly? You know, supposing somebody decides they want to build a nuclear power station down the road from you, are you expected to be a nuclear physicist? Well, obviously you're not. You know, the level of information that you should have to vote on that subject would be the average level of information expected from a normal adult with a normal amount of general knowledge. I tend to think in socialism people would be a lot better informed about science, but that's a by the by. So it's not reasonable to expect you to be a nuclear physicist. What is reasonable is to call in nuclear physicists as advisors to inform on that debate. But in the case of a nuclear power station, you could argue that the ramifications of that go far wider than the local region. That you could even say it's a global decision. Should we have nuclear power at all in socialism when you've got this problem of what do you do with waste? So in that situation, you could argue that this should be a global question. And in that case, your self-defined need to vote may have to be supported by independent assessment from global nuclear experts in nuclear physics. Okay. So as I say, these are not fudges. This is real world grey area stuff. You can't always get what you want, and you can't always know everything that you need to know. And what do I care? This is a question about commitment, really. This is, do I care doesn't mean, do I feel a powerful urge to whinge about this subject? It means, am I prepared to do something about this? Am I prepared to put effort into it if I'm able? If you're not able to do anything physically, you know, because of age or, you know, infirmity, then fine, you know, you can answer yes to the question if you can, you know, participate in the debate at least. But if you're not able to do anything practical or useful or constructive because you're too busy with other things, then it becomes a question of your priorities. Nobody can say, honestly, that they care about everything. You have to draw the line somewhere. If you're too busy really to deal with the subject, opt out of it, because that's your choice. If you say that you care and then you don't do anything, the cluster may start to question whether you should be involved at all. And they could even decide to revoke your voting privilege. Maybe that sounds harsh, but organic democracy is not about carrying dead weight. That's what makes it organic. So what happens if they do decide that you've not, pulled your finger out and done anything, and they do revoke your voting right? Do you have some? Can you protest? Can you appeal? Sure, you can raise a protest, and the protest becomes a social issue. If people think it is, if people think that you've got a case, then people will cluster around it and deal with it the same way they would any other issue of the day. If they don't think you've got a case, then you're just going to have to lump it, I'm afraid. As with any social issue, I haven't gone into the mechanics of how people find out about these issues. It doesn't really matter. It could be they're flipping through their phone. These come up as local items or global items. They're looking through in the morning, like you would read a newspaper, and people are looking, you know, while they're having a coffee or something in the morning. Doesn't really matter. I'm interested in that, I'll join that. I'm interested, I'll join that. Okay, that's the mechanics. Okay, so local complaints, protests, things like that, same as any other type of issue. The bigger the dispute, the bigger the cluster. As I mentioned with the nuclear power thing, it's not impossible that a cluster could be include the entire global population if the subject was going to affect everybody like that. So these clusters, I haven't really talked about these. This is whoever it is that forms around this subject. They're not elected. Nobody elects anybody. They self-select into the cluster. Now, self-selecting clusters always have to accept anyone who meets the three conditions, the rule of three. They have to, otherwise they're not being democratic. Now, so they must always be accessible and transparent. How they do that is up to them, whether they publish bulletins or updates or reports or they hold public meetings or online or whatever they do. These clusters, to fulfil their democratic sort of status, have to be accessible, visible, and accept anyone who meets the three conditions, unless they've got a good reason not to. Like, we're in Japan, you're not, you shouldn't be in this. If you don't know what a cluster does, you should be able to find out easily enough. If you can't find out, that'll be because the cluster has withheld information. They're being obscure, they're being secretive. That's unethical. Okay. Right. So one thing that this does is it straight away gets rid of the idea of socialists voting in meetings all day, every day, in council chambers, putting their hands up, going through agendas, looking at amendments, looking at substantive amendments, resolutions, and addendums and all this sort of thing, council minutes, all that sort of deadening thing that we deal with a lot of in our organisation, and some conferences you can see people just kind of, you know, collapse, and visitors just think, oh my God, how tedious is this? And it really is. It's some of it. It's god-awful tedious. Now, one of the things I said right off the front about the mandatory democracy model is it assumes that everybody who can vote should vote, and also should be interested. And if they're not interested and they're not voting, which we see a lot of in capitalism, it automatically suggests that there's something wrong with the system, or there's something wrong with them. Now, with the rule of three, it's quite the opposite. You can imagine a situation where somebody is fairly happy with things as they're going on in socialism. It's all working out. They've got things to do. Not really got any issues. You can imagine someone like that never voting ever. And that doesn't mean there's something wrong with them. It means that everything is functioning normally. So in socialism, with the rule of three, if there's very little voting going on a large scale, that doesn't mean that the system is broken. It means it's working properly. And if people aren't voting very much, it means that they don't have any particular problems that they need to involve themselves in. So it's kind of taking all the bureaucracy out of socialism. It's taking all of that sort of this structure, this kind of complex, you know, the whole archery thing with the tiny little centre and all the periphery. It's taking all that away and replacing it just with spontaneous clusters that come into being to deal with things and then sort of go away. It's a bit like in physics, there are these virtual particles that appear and disappear in empty space just constantly, something like that. Just like that. That's what these clusters would be like. So would there be kind of big central organisations? I think there would. I think you'd need to be thinking about things like health services. This isn't something that springs up overnight, solves one person's operation and then disappears again. Obviously not. So there are probably other things you can think of that would be, distribution networks probably need constant managing, things like that, production systems and things like that, even though they'd be local. Okay, so some things, but the assumption, there isn't a sort of assumed structure for dealing with things. That gets us away from this idea of, you know, what we were doing last night, designing town centres and stuff like that. With this kind of model, you don't have to design a democratic structure. You just wait and see what the issues are, and the structure grows out of the issues organically. And it sort of grows with as the issues grow, and then it shrinks as they disappear. A different way of working. So not too much democracy, not a lot of bureaucracy really. It's simple. Instead of like having loads and loads, you know, a guidebook or a rule book this thick to explain what you can vote on, what you can. It's just three simple conditions. You can explain that to quite a young child and they'll get that straight away. You know, it's really easy. Children can be involved in this process if they want to be. You know, it doesn't matter how old they are, the conditions apply to them just as much as to somebody older. Do you know about the subject? Do you care about it? Does it affect you? You know, any child can understand that. So that's as bureaucratic as the system has to be. Okay, and so I'm going to wind up now. You'll be delighted to hear. But just to as a rider to this, I did sort of 20 years ago. In fact, Bill reminded me about this not so long ago. That I'd almost forgotten about it. It was that long ago. Back in the 1990s, this was all kind of, you know, horizon tech we were talking about. I mean, we couldn't really imagine these kind of live Discord hybrid meetings back then. That was pie in the sky. And similarly, this kind of approach to democracy back then seemed a bit airy-fairy, and it's like, yeah, okay, maybe in the future, but can't really see it now. But just over the last year or so, while the party's been basically working through Discord, exclusively through that, We have actually seen this sort of thing start to happen. The traditional party structures of committees mostly didn't do anything on discord this year. It was almost like the ones that did operated the way they'd always done, through email and stuff like that. I mean, I don't mean that they weren't doing anything, they were just doing it in the old-fashioned way. But what happened in Discord was that people did sort of spontaneously get together to cluster around issues, or not issues as in problems, but issues as in things that we want to do. Why can't we do, let's see if we can do this. Oh yeah, that's a good idea. Let's see who else wants to be involved in that. So a few people get involved in doing that. Didn't always work. Some things we had to go at didn't really last very long. Other things have been sort of more permanent, like the COP26 thing is one of these where people just spontaneously like, there's this thing, COP26 in November, let's get together and talk about that. That didn't go through any committee. It wasn't led by any committee or the EC or anything like that. That was completely spontaneous. And there's been a few other things like that as well, to do with means and workshops and stuff. So we have the means now, because of the online, because of Discord, to do this sort of thing. And, you know, nobody kind of made this happen, it just kind of did by itself. It was spontaneous, it was organic, in a way that we've never really seen that before. So that would be my conclusion, is that 20 years ago, this did seem a bit pie in the sky. But now, it's almost like, whether we even agree with this or not, or want this to happen, it seems to me that this is probably how things are going to go in the future. And I honestly, unless somebody can come up with an absolute killer reason why this couldn't work in socialism, I can imagine this is how people would work in practice in socialism. So, like the party now, you've got this kind of official, you know, mandatory democratic structure, the hierarchy, horizontal hierarchy and all that. We've got all that. But underneath that, the reality of the last year was people were acting quite spontaneously, talking together on Discord, you know, not circumventing the party democracy, you know, sending reports to the EC and stuff to keep the membership in the loop, but not feeling the need to go through these committees and all that sort of thing, you know, and just self-selecting into a, you know, self-organising cluster to deal with a specific task. So that's my suggestion for the future, is that socialism does not have to be a bureaucratic nightmare. It could be very easy to operate, very simple. You just select into what you want, what you're interested in, what you know about, and leave the rest to other people who care more than you do. Okay, that's it basically. Thank you.